Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Moira Burse, Campaign Director with Amazon Watch, who talks about her group's response to the unprecedented number of fires that have been set in the Amazon rainforest and the grave threat it poses to the Earth's climate. Jeff Carter, Executive Director of the group Physicians for Social Responsibility, who assesses the inherent danger and enormous cost of a new U.S.-Russia nuclear arms race that appears to be now underway. And O.J. Siemens, co-director of the Native American voter advocacy group Four Directions, who discusses the presidential candidate debate his group recently sponsored in Iowa and the issues of major concern to Native communities. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Deposed Sudan President Omar Hassan al-Bashir went on trial in Khartoum on August 19th, facing corruption and money laundering charges. During the first day of the trial, a police investigator claimed Bashir had accepted $90 million in payments from Saudi Arabia's royal family. When police raided Bashir's home, they reportedly found 6 million euros in cash, along with $351,000 and around 5 million Sudanese pounds. In addition to the corruption charges, Bashir also faces a decade-old International Criminal Court war crimes indictment for atrocities committed by his forces in Darfur, where 300,000 people died, and a second criminal inquiry over the killing of pro-democracy activists during the protests that led to his ouster. After a decades-long civil war, Bashir agreed to allow South Sudan, a region with the bulk of the nation's oil reserves, to break away in 2011. The loss of oil revenue led to harsh austerity and rising food prices, which contributed to the protests and Bashir's eventual downfall. On August 17th, Sudan's military and civilian leaders signed a power-sharing agreement to run the country jointly for the next 3 years until national elections can be held. A transitional government run by civilians with a senior general in charge is scheduled to assume power on September 1st. The mass shooting at a Walmart store in El Paso, Texas, where 22 people were murdered, alarmed Mexico's president, Andrés López Obrador. One-third of the victims in the bloody massacre were Mexican nationals. In response, Obrador urged U.S. legislators to reflect on the indiscriminate sale of guns across the U.S.-Mexico border. Mexico's foreign minister, Marcelo Ebrard, went further, threatening to open up a terrorist probe across the border. According to the Center for American Progress, 70% of guns captured by law enforcement in Mexico were first purchased from licensed firearms dealers in the United States. Some estimates put the number of U.S. weapons smuggled from the U.S. into Mexico at over 200,000 annually. Research found that when the 1994 U.S. ban on assault weapons expired in 2004, Mexican municipalities on the U.S. border saw a spike in homicides. Mass shootings in the U.S. have also stoked fears of growing gun violence in Canada. On the same weekend as the massacres in El Paso and in Dayton, Ohio, 17 shootings were reported in Toronto in more than 14 different incidents. Canadian law enforcement blames the flow of guns from the United States for increased violence in Canadian cities. Gun violence in Canada has spiked 40% since 2013. The advocacy group Canadian Doctors for Protection from Guns is now pushing for a ban on handguns and assault-style rifles. The proposed construction of a controversial natural gas pipeline that would cross the iconic Appalachian Trail, a proposal backed by the Trump administration, has been blocked by a federal court. In a landmark ruling last December, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond temporarily halted the project. The court found that the entire 2,100-mile-long Appalachian Trail that traverses 14 states from Georgia to Maine is part of the National Park System, a fact which effectively blocks federal agencies from authorizing a pipeline crossing. The decision upended the U.S. natural gas industry and also jeopardizes other pipeline projects with proposed routes across the trail. The case, now being appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court by Dominion Energy and the Trump regime, will decide the fate of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, a $7.5 billion, 600-mile, 42-inch diameter pipe that would carry fracked natural gas from West Virginia. If built, the pipeline would run up and over several mountain ranges to coastal Virginia and then to eastern North Carolina. If the Supreme Court declines to hear the case, dubbed Cow Pasture River Preservation Association versus U.S. Forest Service, then the Fourth Circuit decision will stand and the Atlantic Coast Pipeline will likely be doomed unless it gets a congressional exemption or Dominion chooses a costly new route. An announcement is expected this fall. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruth Ann Baumgartner.
For several weeks, tens of thousands of fires have been burning down large areas of the Amazon rainforest. The fires, in the world's largest rainforest, has sent clouds of smoke across the region, darkened skies over Brazil's largest city, Sao Paulo, and pumped tons of carbon into the Earth's atmosphere. The number of fires in Brazil's Amazon since January 2019 totals more than 74,000. An increase of 84% from the same period last year, according to data from Brazil's National Institute of Space. Most of the fires have been set intentionally by large ranchers and giant agribusiness firms seeking to clear the forest for cattle grazing and the planting of cash crops. Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, campaigned on a pledge to repeal environmental protections, open up the Amazon to development, and challenge indigenous peoples' control of large swaths of the rainforest region. Bolsonaro, who's been widely criticized for his government's role in encouraging illegal deforestation, was recently offered some $20 million by the Group of Seven Nations to assist in fighting fires in the Amazon. Your reporter spoke with Moira Burse, campaign director with the group Amazon Watch, who talks about the scale of the fires burning across the Amazon, the role of Brazilian President Bolsonaro, and what the international community can do to limit the damage to the planet's environment and climate.
Right now, there are about 10,000 forest fires raging across the Brazilian Amazon. That's covering an immense amount of land. I think most of course, the statistics from Brazil are in hectares, but I think that's around 1,500 square miles. And it's an increase of about 84% over last year, and some of the highest numbers that the Brazilian Institute that tracks this has seen since at least 2013. It's also important to note that there are also fires raging in Bolivia and Peru right now. Some of those fires are in the edges of the Amazon that touch those countries. Also in some of the savanna, more dry forests that cover big parts of Bolivia in particular. So the scale is really quite massive and really devastating because the Amazon is an ecosystem that's incredibly important. It's important because of the biodiversity. It's one of the most biodiverse places in the world because of the cultural diversity. There are hundreds of indigenous nationalities that call the Amazon home. And it's important because of the way that it helps stabilize the global climate. The 20% of the world's oxygen statistic is a little bit in dispute. I think the most important thing to understand about the Amazon's contributions to the climate and climate stability are that it absorbs about 25% of the world's carbon dioxide, or it has been until it's been destroyed so widely. Because of the immense amount of moisture that all of those trees in this rich tropical area produce, it also contributes an immense amount to rainfall patterns throughout the Western Hemisphere.
Moira, how were these fires started? And tell us about the role of Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro and his policies since coming in to the presidency of Brazil.
It's pretty clear the vast majority of these fires were started by farmers and ranchers who were trying to clear more land to expand agribusiness operations. And in fact, there have been several of them who've been quoted in the Brazilian press claiming responsibility, happily and proudly claiming responsibility for having started these fires. And in fact, a few of them have explicitly stated that they did so inspired by Jair Bolsonaro and his rhetoric. He's been since his campaign and then putting this into action since he took office in January, has been talking about the supposed need to open the Amazon for business and using really xenophobic rhetoric in terms of saying that the indigenous peoples there aren't fit to take care of it and that they couldn't possibly be happy just living in the forest. And he has, since taking office, slashed environmental protections. He slashed the budgets of environmental enforcement agencies and indigenous rights agencies. He has fired the heads of many of those agencies that were in place before he took office. With his rhetoric, has really encouraged deforestation for agribusiness and mining.
It seems that as a planet, we are at the mercy of these politicians who are either climate change deniers or solidly in the pocket of the fossil fuel developers and have no concern about the planet's future. And it seems that more dramatic, more radical action may be necessary at a point in the near future to rein in what could doom the entire planet, that could doom human civilization, could doom the future of all the planet's many species and ecosystems. What are you thinking about in terms of collective action that the planet must take to protect our very existence on planet Earth?
Yeah, I mean, I think you named really well the stakes here. And at Amazon Watch, we are doing a number of things, and we are rallying with allies to build our capacities. But one of the things we're doing is calling for a global day of action on September 5th. And we've invited folks from around the world to join that day of action and organize in their cities and towns as they see fit. And we imagine there'll be many more. And of course, this is we will be bringing the issue of the Amazon, and I'm sure we won't be the only ones bringing it to the climate strike, the global climate strike, later in September. You're so right that we need to be, you know, taking to the streets to really demand action from our politicians. We also think that it's really important to be supporting the indigenous peoples and communities on the ground. You know, we've gotten a lot of attention and donations in the past week and few days since the fires really gained global attention. And we are working to pass as much of that support as we can directly to the communities and organizations that themselves are on the front lines of this fight and are standing up day and night to both the wildcat miners or loggers in the rainforest, but also to the politicians in Brazil and in other parts of the Amazon where we work to prevent more rollbacks on protections and, in fact, to spur positive action.
That was Moira Burse, campaign director with the group Amazon Watch. Learn more about what people around the world are doing to assist in protecting the Amazon rainforest by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On August 19th, just days after the world marked the 74th anniversary of the only use of nuclear weapons in war, the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Pentagon began conducting a test of a new generation of ground-launched cruise missiles, once prohibited under the 1987 U.S.-Russia Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, or INF, treaty that the Trump regime withdrew from on August 2nd. Along with President Obama's 2016 authorization of a $1.7 trillion plan to modernize the U.S. nuclear arsenal over the next 3 decades, and President George W. Bush's 2001 withdrawal from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, signed with the Soviet Union in 1972, we're seeing the rapid disintegration of the nuclear arms control framework that had been in place for decades. Another indication of the new nuclear arms race that appears to be now underway was a radioactive explosion in Russia on August 8th that was linked with a failed test of an experimental nuclear-powered cruise missile. Your reporter spoke with Jeff Carter, executive director of the group Physicians for Social Responsibility. Here he talks about the dangers and enormous cost inherent in the revival of a new U.S.-Russia nuclear arms race, and his group's advocacy for congressional passage of a no-first-use policy on nuclear weapons.
Make no mistake about it, we are right now, most experts agree, we are in the most serious crisis in nuclear arms control since the 1980s. Think about it this way, with the recent collapse of the INF Treaty and the New START Treaty is due to expire in 2021, we would be left at that point without any limits at all on the nuclear arsenals of nuclear states for the first time since 1972. And for those who remember the days of the Cold War, that was a pretty scary time. And for those who don't remember, put aside just the expense, the billions and trillions of dollars that we've spent in the past and we're spending now to modernize, as you mentioned, to modernize nuclear weapons, which could be spent on other things, that's an important issue. But the other issue is the real danger that a mistake is made. Even a limited nuclear exchange would have devastating effects to the planet. We've made terrific progress since the 80s in reducing nuclear stockpiles around the world. We went from a high of over 70,000 active weapons back in 1986, and right now we have about 13,890 total nuclear warheads in the world, which sounds like a lot, and it is. Only about 3,750 of those are active. So these treaties were really instrumental in bringing those numbers down, and more importantly, or as important, building trust between particularly the United States and Russia, which holds by far the most of these nuclear warheads. And now that's all gone.
Jeff, in your view, what is the cause of this falling away of all these great accomplishments in reining in the nuclear arms race? Why are we at this point now?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, the most immediate problem right now is, quite frankly, with the current administration in the White House. We have a national security advisor right now who really views any of these treaties as a unnecessary restraint on U.S. sovereignty. That's a big problem. We have a president who, he seems to have very little understanding of what our nuclear weapons do, how dangerous they are. I was just reading the other day, he was talking about using nuclear weapons when killer storms are approaching, that he suggested perhaps we could nuke them to dissipate them or something along those lines. It's a dangerous situation when we have folks in the White House who do understand this stuff but basically think these treaties are unnecessary and are in favor of building up our nuclear weapons arsenal, and other folks who I don't think really understand the seriousness of the issue. But make no mistake, Scott, this has been a problem for a while now. It goes beyond just this administration. As you mentioned, you know, we pulled out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty back in 2002. So we have this history now of pulling out of treaties. It's not only the United States' responsibility, but we do have a lead role in maintaining these treaties. And if we think there's something in these treaties that needs to be improved, to go to the negotiating table and work those things out. What scares me as much as these treaties going away and the lack of agreements is the fact that we're not talking. Built into these treaties, something like the INF or New START, there are inspection regimens that are built into these things so we could see what they were doing and they could see what we were doing. So it's really a scary time right now because the lack of treaties, the lack of discussion, and quite frankly, the lack, I think, of taking the issue seriously by certain members of the administration have put us in what I would call pretty grave danger.
What can you tell us about the presidential candidates who are running for the White House and any positions they've staked out in terms of changing direction when it comes to reining in this new nuclear arms race?
There are some encouraging signs there. Of course, mostly we're hearing from Democrats. I know there are a few Republicans thinking about getting into the race, but among the Democratic candidates, we do have several candidates talking about this issue. most notably right now, Senator Elizabeth Warren. She is actually the sponsor of something called the No First Use Act in the Senate. This came up during one of the presidential debates. As scary as this issue is, for many of us who work in it, it doesn't necessarily make the front page or resonate as much as some other issues do. So I was pleased to see that issue come up during the debates. There are a couple other members of the Senate running for president, Senator Sanders and Senator Gillibrand, who are co-sponsors of that legislation. And just to tell you what that No First Use legislation is, it's actually pretty simple. And a lot of people are surprised that this isn't our policy to begin with. But No First Use simply refers to a pledge or a policy by a nuclear power, in this case the United States, not to use nuclear weapons in a conflict unless we are attacked with nuclear weapons by an adversary first. So we think, and many of our colleagues who work on these issues feel, that a new first use policy is a really important first step towards getting this issue back under control and heading in the right direction.
That was Jeff Carter, executive director of the group Physicians for Social Responsibility. Find more analysis and commentary on the erosion of nuclear arms control agreements by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On August 19th and 20th, a group based on the Rosebud Sioux Reservation in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, sponsored the nation's first major presidential forum focused on Native American issues. The debate, named the Frank Lemire Native American Presidential Forum, honors a local man who fought successfully to close down the liquor stores in White Clay, Nebraska, that borders the reservation. The 10 Democratic presidential candidates who participated in the forum included Senators Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Kamala Harris, Marianne Williamson, John Delaney, Steve Bullock, Joe Sestak, Julian Castro, Bill de Blasio, and Amy Klobuchar, in addition to Mark Charles, a member of the Navajo or Diné Nation, running as an independent. Republican candidates were invited but did not attend. Former Vice President Joe Biden, Pete Buttigieg, and Tulsi Gabbard sent regrets. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with O.J. Siemens, co-director of Four Directions, the group sponsoring the forum. Here he talks about the importance of indigenous votes in the battleground states of Arizona, Florida, Michigan, New Hampshire, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, and describes some of the salient issues the indigenous questioners at the forum ask candidates to address.
In July, the middle part of July, we didn't have one candidate. So what we started doing is putting out there more and more the battleground states. There are seven battleground states, and we checked the population of those battleground states. And in each instance, we had a high population of Native Americans within the state that would actually equal or exceed the amount of votes that either candidate won on. We started emphasizing the importance of the Native vote in those seven battleground states. And we looked it up, and we had 77 electoral votes. And so that became our message.
Who came up with the questions?
What Four Directions did is we set the boundaries of what the questions would actually consist of. And we made it so that the questions would all surround treaties and sovereignty. We were able to get a panel of other Native Americans to sit down and start writing out different questions. In order to get the candidates on board, we worked with the National Congress of American Indians. And what we did is the National Congress of American Indians have basically throughout the years developed an Indian Country 101 that covers all issues that have been presented by tribes throughout the years that have always been a problem they wanted answers on. We provided them with the Indian Country 101 as a general learning curve for them to prepare for the questions that were going to be asked. There's only two questions that each candidate knew exactly what the questions were going to be. and that was the Remove the Stain Act, which was the legislation we had passed to remove the medals from the soldiers that committed a massacre of Wounded Knee. And the second question they knew that was going to be asked dealt with missing and murdered Indigenous women and children.
I know there has been a lot of opposition to oil pipelines in Indian country. Was there a question about that?
It was basically a general question about pipelines. But the ones that were key that are happening right now is the Keystone KXL pipeline and the Sandstone pipeline going through Minnesota. Although it was a general question about pipelines altogether, it narrowed down to the actual ones that we're fighting right now in federal court and in other ways.
O.J. Siemens, what other questions were asked?
A big one was had to deal with housing. The other one that was major was the transportation or the infrastructure, because our roads have been washed out and we've had tribal members killed because of bad roads. We talked about the opioid crisis and what they plan on doing about it. Healthcare was another big one. So we were pushing for a permanent funding source where we wouldn't have to seek appropriations every year on the Indian Health Services.
Do you consider the forum a success?
Oh, above and beyond. We got equality, just like non-Indians get, of having our voices and issues heard. We've watched the debates and them meeting with other organizations and stuff. And through all of that, not one question was asked about Native Americans. And so I'm really curious to see during the next debate if they're actually going to include a question on Native Americans. If they do that, we've had better success than we thought.
That was O.J. Siemens of the Native American voter advocacy group Four Directions. Learn more about their presidential debate and issues of concern to Native communities by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Progressive Voices Network, WZMO in Marion, Ohio, KMUD in Garberville, California, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Ruth Ann Baumgartner, Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.